This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about Just Getting Started, I, Tonya, Wonder Wheel, and Darkest Hour. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, an interview with Ron Shelton, the director of Just Getting Started, the box office, and of course, the home cinema roundup featuring the Irving Berlin classic, Holiday Inn. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies, or you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Finally, we have a week where there has not been a crazy explosion of sex activity and misconduct in Hollywood. Although there's a couple stories floating around out there, but we've covered so many of them. Let's talk about something different, something a little more uplifting. The Critics' Choice Movie Award nominations have come out this week. I am a voting member of that. Some of these that I actually nominated got some major nominations, which is always kind of rare. It's always hit or miss because I have tastes that don't always jive with the other critics out there. So it was kind of neat to see this list come out, and a good chunk of them are ones that I actually agree with. In fact, The Shape of Water has currently 14 nominations, which include Best Picture, Best Actress, Best Supporting Actor, Best Supporting Actress, and Best Director, and that's a great movie. I'll talk more about that one next week. Other big nomination hauls include Lady Bird, which is a great movie, The Post, which is a great movie, and Call Me By Your Name and Dunkirk, also getting 8 nominations. I'm not a big fan of either of those movies. Again, I'll talk more about Call Me By Your Name, I believe, next week. But I'm pretty happy with the nominations. I mean, there was a bunch of technical awards for Blade Runner 2049, which we all expected, and it completely deserves. So it's actually a nice list. Now, if you want to find the full list, you can go to my Twitter page or Facebook page, and I link those out there so you can get a breakdown of them. But if you want to watch the Critics' Choice Movie Awards, you can watch that on Thursday, January 8th at 8 p.m. Eastern on the CW. So we'll see if anything that I actually like wins anything. You know, hopefully Dunkirk doesn't walk away with all this stuff, or Call Me By Your Name, although that one's probably going to win a bunch. Anyways, let's talk about the next piece of news. Quentin Tarantino is interested in doing Star Trek, and this has been swirling around, and I even had a friend at one of the station affiliates who was emailing me, what do you think about this? And I go, I'll believe it when they're actually on set. And I wouldn't say film rolling through the camera, although it is Quentin Tarantino, and he'll probably want to shoot on film. I don't necessarily believe that this is going to come to fruition. I feel that this is going to be like Edgar Wright's Ant-Man movie that gets a lot of buzz, a lot of news, and then when they finally figure out, I mean, I think in script stage, Paramount's going to be flexing its muscles and dictating what should and shouldn't happen, mainly because it's one of their biggest franchises. It's a successful franchise. And also because they've got a brand new TV series, Star Trek Discovery, that Paramount is really getting behind. And even though I didn't watch it because of some broadcast issues, it certainly seems that Paramount is throwing behind this new series. And when you bring it in like Quentin Tarantino, he's a very, I mean, I like his stuff. Most of his stuff I actually tend to enjoy. But you're bringing in somebody who's very highly stylized and very particular on how he likes to shoot things. I really don't think that this is going to go. I mean, he's talking about doing it as an R-rated movie, and that's fine. You know, after the success of Deadpool and Logan, they're saying, okay, yeah, let's do these franchise movies as R-rated. But, you know, Star Trek, I mean, you're still going to have the suits in there saying, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do this, let's do this, change this. And I just don't think Quentin Tarantino is going to take it. So this will get abandoned in script stage, or it'll just languish there. I remember what The Hateful Eight was like 10 years in the making before he ended up even getting that film to come out last year. And so I really don't have any sort of faith at all that Quentin Tarantino's going to be shooting a Star Trek movie, let alone a finishing one. A couple other pieces of news in terms of franchise films. Matt Reeves is going to be recasting Ben Affleck as Batman in his standalone film. I think that's a bad move because I think Ben Affleck is one of the better Batmans we've had. But, you know, when has DC ever listened to me? The idea of going to a younger guy, if you want to reboot it, you want to take it as a younger, but just please don't do an origin story. But I think that's not a terrible idea. And in fact, I'd be all for having different people playing Batman. I wouldn't mind having Ben Affleck come back and doing the Justice League. It's like reading the comic books where a different artist would draw him differently, and you kind of had different storylines going on. I'd say open it up. It doesn't all have to take place in this little box. But in terms of the DC universe, I was reading an article the other day where it's like, oh, Justice League isn't a moneymaker. And people are just so dying to hate on Justice League, and they have been for years. And the reality is, it's not a flop. It's not a cash cow. I mean, it's not like Avengers making $1 billion, and it's on the low end, certainly, of the DC universe. But don't let's not start having a bake sale for Warner Brothers so they can cover the production costs of Justice League. It's not going to end up in the red, but it's also not going to make a ton of money. It's not going to be something that brings in a ton of cash for Warner Brothers, but it's still going to cover the books. Now, they may report it as a loss, and that's what they do sometimes. They sometimes hide their losses in big movies that have just a huge balance sheet, but that was done with the Harry Potter film, so that's nothing new. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one is Thoroughbreds. It's a sort of a dark comedy. It opens on March 9th.
I don't have any feelings, ever. And that doesn't necessarily make me a bad person. It just means I have to work a little harder to be good.
You hate him. You despise him.
Honey, you can't go in looking like that.
I'm fine. I'm not going to have to stand here all day like a robot repeating myself. I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm fine.
You ever think about just killing him?
How would you?
I think this is an interesting idea just because I'm sort of fascinated with psychopathy where people don't have human emotions. And I'm not talking about it in sort of like this Asperger syndrome spectrum sort of way. I'm talking about somebody who like is a psychopath who, but also is still trying to be a decent person. I find that to be a fascinating realm to play around in. This could be an interesting movie in terms of looking at morals and ethics and the way the world works, whether or not you have emotions. The next one I want to talk about is, of course, the one that everyone was talking about this week, and that is Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. It opens on June 22nd.
A rescue op. Save the dinosaurs from an island that's about to explode. What could go wrong?
These creatures were here before us. And if we're not careful, they're gonna be here after. Life cannot be contained.
First of all, this trailer dropped, and before it, they did all these like 15-second teases, and I'm pretty sure if you edited together the 15-second teases, you got most of the trailer already. So it was, you know, dropped on Thursday night, but everyone kind of had the full trailer in bits and pieces since like Monday or something. The other thing I have to note is this doesn't exactly excite me. I am kind of cold on this trailer. It's not that I'm not wanting to see the movie. I still am curious to see where they go. I was of the mind where I thought Jurassic World was a perfectly fine movie, but a utter shocker that it made as much money or as big of a splash as it did because I wasn't expecting it to. But still, overall, I mean, you're going to have dinosaurs. You're going to have people running around. It looks like it's got some great special effects. It just looks really, and I'm saying this, and this is a complaint people do, is it looks dark. It looks like dim. It looks like everything's shot in cloud cover. And that's supposed to be because they're on this island with a volcano. But part of the thing I did like about Jurassic World, I wouldn't call it the original, but, you know, the reboot, is that it was vibrant and colorful, and now this looks like everything's just under a glaze. You see that a lot in sequels. They try and go dark. They try and get gritty and realistic. You saw that in The Lost World, which was the first Jurassic Park sequel. So I don't know. I'm still going to see it. I'm still interested in seeing it. I'm curious to see whether they can replicate the surprise success of Jurassic World with a $200 million opening next summer. That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about I, Tonya and Wonder Wheel. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews. The first one is going to be I, Tonya, and I'm going a little early on this one. This has just got its qualifying release this weekend, so most likely, if you're hearing this review, you can't just run out to the theater and see it. But probably next week, it's going to be rolling out, and the fact that it's getting some award nominations for Margot Robbie as Tonya Harding, I think is going to help its distribution levels in the next coming weeks. But I want to get this here because it's just going to get lost in the sea of reviews over the next couple weeks, because we have 186 movies opening between now and Christmas, which is like 2 weeks away. So let's talk about I, Tonya. This biopic looks back at the media frenzy surrounding Tonya Harding and the scandal of the 1992 Winter Olympics.
America. They want someone to love. But they want someone to hate. And the haters always say, Tonya, tell the truth. There's no such thing as truth. I mean, it's bullshit.
I am now at the age where they're making historical movies. They're making period pieces about stuff, not just that I lived through, but that I was like an adult during. And I'm not talking about like when they were making Iraq war films like 5 or 6 years ago, and those were just less than 10 years ago kind of movies. I'm talking about like, this is a bona fide period piece with costume design and reeking of 90s clothing. And it's interesting to look back because, you know, it's one thing to watch a movie that you lived through the subject matter when you were like a kid, like Watergate movies that are coming out now. I was like in diapers when Watergate was going on. So I remember the 70s, but not, you know, like the Battle of the Sexes, same thing. I was a little kid during that. And I remember the 70s, but not as an adult, because I was an adult in the 70s. I was an adult in the 90s. And I remember the media frenzy. Well, the movie's interesting. And Margot Robbie does a fine performance as Tonya Harding. It's a bit of a stretch because she's just, I mean, inherently gorgeous. There's not anything you could do to Margot Robbie except for put her in a Hobbit mask to not make her unimaginably gorgeous. Even in her most dulled down look, she's still gorgeous. That's just the way Margot Robbie is. There is a little bit of a disconnect because she doesn't look like Tonya Harding. Tonya Harding is a very different shape to her. She's not like a gorgeous model. She's sort of cute. And one of the things with Tonya Harding, and they address this, is she sort of comes from the lower economy. She's a bit, and I use this term with all the love that goes along with it, knowing that there's plenty of people that I know and are in my life who could possibly fit in this category, but kind of white trashy is how a lot of people, she's always appeared. And you don't think of Margot Robbie as kind of fitting that, you know, middle American white trash look, but she tries her hardest and she does a good job acting. I think she's actually the driving force behind this movie. But the thing that as interesting as her performances and as significant as her performances, I think the thing that I find more interesting is how it looks back on the way the media was and how tabloid television was really getting its claws in there. We had stuff like Inside Edition and Current Affair that it started showing up in the 80s and had sort of hit that frenzy of the 90s. That's before cable really diversified, before you had internet and like stuff like Netflix. you had a lot of also these TV talk shows, like Jerry Springer, of course, led the pack. The daytime talk shows where people just like to watch people torpedo their lives. And that's what this was. This was a real life tabloid TV explosion that happened in the 90s, and we got to watch it all happen. And you can see where everybody wants the arc of the story. They want the bad guy, which was Tonya Harding and Jeff Galooly and the people involved. And you wanted the good guy, which was Nancy Kerrigan. But then we find out that Nancy Kerrigan is kind of has her own issues, and you know, the tabloid media loves to build somebody up and take them down. And that's essentially what goes on in this, but forgetting that there are real people behind this. So I think that that's overall, it does kind of follow the same sort of biopic lines. It punches the same holes and pushes those same buttons that we've seen before. But overall, it's an entertaining movie to watch, if not for anything else than just to watch sort of a snapshot of the past from 25 years ago, and to watch Margot Robbie do a pretty good performance. So I'm going to have to say I, Tonya kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Wonder Wheel. Woody Allen directs this film about a wayward daughter who comes back to Coney Island in the 1950s after marrying a mobster, only to vie for the affections of a lifeguard with her stepmother.
Excuse me? Do you know if Jenny's here?
I'm Jenny.
I'm Humpty's daughter. You're his wife?
Is he gonna be surprised?
I'm marked. They're gonna kill me.
That's what you get when you marry a gangster.
I gotta have a drink.
No, Humpty, you've been good.
Damn it!
When you're married to a man who got rich putting people's feet in cement, you probably never had to do a dish. You know she's a marked woman.
Can she move on?
I know where all the bodies are buried.
This is a little bit atypical of Woody Allen simply because of the cinematography. Though that's honestly the one reason to see the movie is the vibrant, colorful cinematography. It glorifies Coney Island in the 50s. Now, I did not grow up in New York. I've never been to Coney Island, but I've, you know, heard the stories. And if you talk to a lot of people who were especially young in the 1950s, that was the heyday of Coney Island. And he looks at it with these rose colored spectacles. And this is such a love letter to Coney Island. It's him doing what he was doing for so many years in terms of Woody Allen, falling in love with a city or a location. I mean, he did that with Midnight in Paris. He did that with Vicky Cristina Barcelona. You know, he even did that with Match Point to a degree of falling in love with London. He sort of did his European travelogue. And I think he did Spain and Magic in the Moonlight. And now he's back to doing American stuff. And he's back to do this one takes place in Coney Island, where he grew up and he has a lot of love for. And there's even little nods to Annie Hall, where you've got the roller coaster. It's not that they live under the roller coaster like in Annie Hall, but it's a very colorful Woody Allen movie. And you normally don't get that. Normally his stuff's very muted. And but that's, I think, the influence of his European work. Really, the palette of the film is the reason to see it. I mean, Kate Winslet stars as the stepmom, and she's good. I mean, she's fine, but I mean, the story's very forgettable. There's a certain type of Woody Allen screwball comedy that you'd see in Annie Hall, which it's not for everybody, but he does work he worked in comedy. That's where he got his start. If you watch a movie like Take the Money and Run, something like that, that's a little more broad comedy. He'd left that behind. And here, I mean, it's almost like he can't decide whether he wants this to be a lighthearted comedic film. And he never quite commits to that in any scene. And I think it's him trying to do drama that wants to be comedy, but the movie does just unravel. Once you get to like the third act, it just boom, opens up like a parachute. And honestly, gun to my head, I couldn't tell you how it ended. That's how unimpressed I was with like the last third of the film. I was watching it and it kind of had my attention and it was neat to see and it has good actors. I mean, you know, Justin Timberlake's in it. I like Justin Timberlake. I think he's an underrated actor. So it had these good actors, but then it just kind of fell apart. So this one's nothing to write home about. Look at the pictures. It looks pretty. But that's about it. Wonder Wheel kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Just Getting Started and Darkest Hour. Take a
a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Gonna roll into the movie reviews, continue with them. Let's talk about Just Getting Started. Morgan Freeman and Tommy Lee Jones play men trying to be the top dog at an old folks' home in Palm Springs.
I'm Duke Diver, resident manager of this resort community. Music!
He's a resident champion of everything around here.
There's new food on the buffet.
What the? 20 minutes, he's got them lined up for a three-way.
Four-way if anybody's counting.
Did you move to Villa Capri just to piss me off?
No, that was just a happy byproduct.
You and I, just getting started.
This is the only brand new wide release of the week. We had The Disaster Artist, which I talked about last week. But The Disaster Artist finally went wide this week. So a lot of people are seeing that now. Go see that. That's a great movie. But go see The Room first. Now, Just Getting Started is the only completely new, hasn't been in theaters yet, and it's directed by Ron Shelton, and he's best known for movies like Bull Durham. He does a lot of sports movies. He did Bull Durham, he did Tin Cup, and he did Cobb, which is the story of Ty Cobb, not Donald Trump's lawyer, but the baseball player. He's done a whole bunch. He did boxing, he's done golf, he's done baseball. He's a former baseball player, and this is a departure from the sports world. So it's not his sports movies. And that's okay, because he's done movies that aren't sports films before. This is, the best way I can describe it is it's a movie for an older generation. Not that you can't understand it and enjoy it. I mean, I'm 46 and I watch, and I had some laughs during it, and it's certainly enjoyable watching the actors. I mean, Morgan Freeman, he's great in everything. Even in terrible movies, he's really good in. And Tommy Lee Jones is interesting to watch and fun to watch. It does remind me a little bit of the movie Hope Springs, a very different content, but the movie Hope Springs starred Tommy Lee Jones and Meryl Streep, and they were going to a sex therapy getaway. It reminds me of that because that movie was a perfectly well-done movie and very good performances by everybody involved, but certainly not for my generation. It was about a couple who were in their 60s or 70s and sort of having to deal with rekindling their relationship. And this one feels similar. Now, I'm going to be talking to Ron Shelton later in the show, so we'll get an interview from his perspective of making this film. But one of the things he did tell me is this is the kind of place you go to party, not to retire. And I thought that was an interesting way of looking at it. And apparently these places do exist where, you know, there's old folks homes that are the traditional old folks home. I mean, my grandmother was in one, and you go to these one and they're very typical, you know, they've got old people there and they're just kind of wandering around. They're playing bingo and, you know, eating soup at lunch. You know, what you'd expect for an old folks home, you know, a nice old folks home. But apparently there are these retirement homes that are kind of a big party that these people have reached the age in their life where they don't care. And maybe they're no longer with their partner because they're widowed or whatever. So they're maybe sowing their wild oats a little bit later in life. So it's an interesting look at these locations. And like I said, they do exist. It's also an interesting movie because it's a Christmas movie. It takes place at Christmas and it has all the Christmas decorations, and they have like a nativity scene at this place with real camels and stuff. The whole point of the movie is here it is in this very warm climate, yet you have all this Christmas decorations. And you know, I'm from Ohio, so to me, Christmas decorations mean cold weather. But if you live in the South or you live in, you know, a place like Florida or California, yeah, warm weather is going to be normal for seeing Christmas decorations. I remember I honeymooned in Hawaii, and it was really interesting to go to this open air hotel lobby and you see all these Christmas decorations and icicle lights. And there's no icicles in Hawaii in December or any time, really. But that's just the way it is. If you've grown up in the tropics or in the warm climate, that's what it looks like. So it's not necessarily speaking to me, but I found the interesting. It's either going to be a juxtaposition for you, or it's going to be the way you remember it, that you don't always see it portrayed in the movies. Overall, just getting started, it has some weak writing moments, and it's not a completely cohesive script. It kind of has two different things. There's the sort of trying to be the coolest guy in the club, which is the bulk of the movie and actually the more entertaining part of it. And then there's you're on the run from the mob and they're trying to kill you. And that just is kind of like seems a bit thrown in as a story element. But overall, it's just kind of fun to watch Morgan Freeman and Tommy Lee Jones share the screen. And I felt that way about Going in Style. It came out earlier this year. It was just neat watching him with some great actors. So, like I said, this is going to be more for the senior citizens. But, you know, it's good for a couple laughs. It's a nice little whimsical movie to check out the weekend before Star Wars opens, when that's going to just run roughshod over everything. So I'm going to have to say Just Getting Started kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Darkest Hour. Not the Darkest Hour. There's a huge difference. What's funny is these both have come out at Christmas. The Darkest Hour was that movie that took place in Russia, and it was about these two girls who were visiting Russia, and aliens, invisible aliens invaded, and they're aliens that will make people just disintegrate. That was a terrible movie. It looked interesting because it was in 3D, but it was a terrible movie. I actually paid to go see that one. Now, Darkest Hour is totally different. Gary Oldman stars as the controversial British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, showing how he led the country through World War II.
Mr. Winston Churchill,
you have an enormous task ahead of you.
Winston lacks judgment.
He's a bully. We may have to replace him.
You ask, what is our policy? I say it is to wage war by sea, land, and air with all our might. We shall never surrender!
The biggest thing to point out in Darkest Hour is Gary Oldman's performance. This is one of those chameleon performances, and Gary Oldman's a fantastic actor, and you know, even if you don't like all the movies he's in, he does something different with each role, and he can play over the top and zany. He can play very reserved. He is one of the greatest actors working right now, and he becomes Winston Churchill. It's so tough to see him in the role. He disappears in it. And yeah, there's makeup and there's, but it's not just him wearing old man makeup or anything like that. It's to the point that as you're watching it, you at times forget that it's Gary Oldman. Now, I was not alive when Winston Churchill obviously was knocking around the planet. But I mean, it's an incredible transformation. I mean, this is the one role that's like, this is the forerunner for best actor at the Oscars, at everything else. And while there's still some great performances out there, it's going to be really tough to beat Oldman. And that is the best part of this movie, is his performance. Now, this is directed by Joe Wright, who tends to be very lavish in his movies. He did the movie Pan, which is very lavish. He did Atonement and Pride and Prejudice. And he loves the look and the gorgeousness of life. And that's fine. He tones it back a little bit because he's showing a little bit more of a reserved version of Winston Churchill. And of course, I don't know a whole lot about Winston Churchill just because I don't, like what I see on the History Channel. People look at Winston Churchill in sort of like an Abraham Lincoln kind of perspective, or an FDR kind of perspective, but you forget that there was controversy around him and he had his political enemies. And it's interesting to see how things work. There's not a whole lot of action in this movie, though. That's the biggest part, is it's a lot of talking, and it reminds me a little bit of the King's Speech in that way. Ultimately, The Darkest Hour is a fine movie, and it's a very well done movie. It's a movie, though, I think, honestly, if you take Darkest Hour and were to edit it into Dunkirk, you'd have one heck of a movie. One of my biggest problems with Dunkirk was there was no characters. There was no backdrop to it. It was just the action, which I know people say the purity of Nolan and everything, but this gives you this is like the other part of the movie, which is so important to know what the strategic position and the reasoning was in the Dunkirk rescue. So I really think you could have taken these two movies and edited them together and have a great film, but you kind of get half a movie with Dunkirk. And I wouldn't say you get half a movie with this one. This is more of a character study. But overall, you know, Darkest Hours is a perfectly fine movie. I'm going to have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be interviewing Ron Shelton and talk about the weekly box office and give a little bit of look into the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Holiday Inn. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. We are ready to wrap up the show, but before we wrap up the show, let's talk to Ron Shelton, who's the director of Just Getting Started. And now I know we reviewed the movie in the last segment, but here we got a little bit of insight into how he made the movie, how he cast the movie for a director who's kind of legendary. I mean, going all the way back to Bull Durham. But here's my conversation with Ron Shelton.
Okay, where did they get the name for your company, Fat Guys at the Movies?
Fat Guys at the Movies, it's the most honest name for a movie review show that you're ever going to hear.
Okay.
And it's also, it's very self-serving because no energy has to be expelled to continue using that name whatsoever.
I got it. All right. That's the perfect name.
The first thing I want to ask about this movie is, being that it takes place at Christmas, where does this fall in the Die Hard is a Christmas movie debate, and would you then characterize this as a Christmas film or something else?
I think of it as a Christmas movie, but I'm sure the distributors in the studio and all that, they don't think of it as a Christmas movie. But growing up in Southern California, Christmas to me was, you know, you play golf or baseball, you go swimming, you go to the beach, and music about it snowing is playing at the same time. This is normal.
I mean, obviously the movie's about senior citizens. I mean, it's a senior citizen movie. And I imagine you're hoping it'll do well in places like Miami and Phoenix and warm weather climates, which is where people of an extended age tend to congregate.
Yeah, I'm trying to say in the movie they don't go there to retire, they go there to party. But yeah, that's our core audience and not Brooklyn.
I'm in my mid-40s, so I'm not yet looking at retirement homes. But did you base this on people that you know or retirement homes that you know or places that, like you say, people go to party but not retire?
You know, I didn't know much about the world. It was just kind of was winging it. And then when I wrote the first draft, my friends who I showed the script to, they said, you got to check this out. And sent me like all these links to these places in Florida, especially, that are like Peyton Place. I mean, they're wild. There's swingers, retirement swingers, and this and that. And I thought, well, I didn't go far enough. But, you know, the distributor wanted PG-13, not X. So, and since that, I've read about these things. There are places that are quite wild.
Let's talk about the actors. Now, some of them you've worked with before, obviously, you know, like Tommy Lee Jones and Rene Russo, but how did you go about assembling the cast, and where did you start? Did you start with the people you worked with before? Or?
Well, you start with finding the money. You always start with the money, and then you find who to make offers to. Somebody had suggested Morgan, and he wasn't in my head when I wrote it, but I thought, well, what a great idea, and I'd never met the man. And we made him an offer, and he liked the script a lot and agreed to do it. And then it's, what's next? Well, who would be great opposite Morgan? And I thought Tommy was the great idea, because I think Tommy's got a really wry, dry sense of humor. A lot of people don't. I think I proved I'm right. And Tommy said yes. I called Renee. And then so that's how it evolved. And when Morgan and Tommy turned out they wanted to work together but never had. So once I put them in the same room, I thought, oh my God, I think they're golden together.
Did you allow the actors to have a little bit of leeway with it? Did you do any improvising? I mean, just getting seasoned actors like that together.
These aren't improvisers, none of these actors. They liked it on the page. At the same time, I'm a good listener. So, if they had an idea, I was open to it. If they showed up to shoot at 6 in the morning with an idea, obviously I'm open to it. But pretty much the script that we went in is the script that's on the screen.
This was Glenn Headley's last film. Is that correct?
Sadly, we were shocked and stunned, and we'd all become very fond of her. It is still very sad. She had been a resurgence in her career. She had a series. She was a delight. She was having fun on this movie because she could laugh and play. And, I got off a plane, come back to New York, and I had, all these phone calls saying, you can't believe what happened. So, we haven't quite got over that yet.
You've done so many sports movies. And I mean, there's some golf in this, sure, but it's not a sports movie. Do you feel ever that you were tied too much to sports movies? Is it liberating doing something that's not sports?
The success of Bull Durham was a mixed blessing because now I get every sports script in the world, but I'm not tied to it. I did Dark Blue, was not a sports movie. Hollywood Homicide is not a sports movie. I've got the next one that's been announced, The Escape Artist or Hacksaw Jones is not a sports movie. I go back to sports movies, but I'd say of the 5 or 6 scripts I have in various stages of development or financing, half are sports and half aren't. It's hard to get sports movies made because foreign finance is not interested in American sports.
Do you direct comedy different than you direct drama, even scene to scene?
No, you cast it well and never play it for laughs. I always tell the actors, because sometimes they'll say, this line is funny and I don't feel I'm making it funny. I said, don't make it funny, make it real. I don't care if there's a lot of laughs in this movie or if there's smiles or giggles or you're smiling at it 3 days later. I just want you to be engaged, to be fully engaged in the movie.
Is it tough type, like sort of like directing against type? Like there's the scene where Morgan Freeman gets pretty drunk, and that's not a situation you're used to seeing. The audiences like us are used to seeing him. He's so dignified in everything he does. Was that a daring thing for him, or was he game for that?
Oh, he loved it, and in fact, I extended the scene and added in the truck. What Morgan does is he brings dignity. Even as a drunk Santa trying to pick up on a woman at a bar he doesn't have a chance with, I think that part of Morgan, who is got an elegance to him, comes through even when he's playing a drunken Santa of a kind of a rogue hustler in Witness Protection in Palm Springs, and there's still a dignity, if you know what I mean. And by the way, he plays a great drunk.
He does.
Doesn't he?
Yeah. I'll do some research on that this weekend and find out how good the drinking is.
Good, me too.
All right, thank you so much, and best of luck with the film.
Thank you.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's take a look at the box office just really quick. Last week, it was kind of a weird week because there was nothing new. So Coco, of course, continued at number one, and it made less than $30 million, but that's not bad. I mean, it's total gross. It's well over $100 million. Justice League barely skipped under $200 million of its final for last week. By now, it's $200 million. It's over $200 million. Basically, a repeat of the previous week. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The spotlight this week is Holiday Inn, which is, some people consider it sort of like the what White Christmas was before they made White Christmas. And it is, kind of. It stars Bing Crosby, Fred Astaire, a former entertainer, buys a country inn, which he only opens for spectacular shows on federal holidays.
Holiday Inn. Never has there been such a show as this. From Easter to Christmas, from the 4th of July to Thanksgiving, there's a song for every holiday, and a holiday for every song.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
You'll be the grandest lady in the Easter parade.
The Holiday Inn is best known for where White Christmas came from, and the song White Christmas, which was then spun into White Christmas, which in a way is, like I said, it's kind of a remake of Holiday Inn, only you got Danny Kaye in that one. That one only takes place at Christmas. There's big differences between
Holiday Inn and White Christmas, but there is a lot of connective tissue, part of it being Bing Crosby singing and of course the Irving Berlin connection. The other reason Holiday Inn is best known for is it has this really uncomfortable minstrel show in the middle of it. For the song Abraham, which takes place on Abraham Lincoln's birthday, and you've got Bing Crosby in blackface. Really, I mean, it's horribly racist. It's well, we watch it as a family, and that section was so uncomfortable to watch. It was alarming. It was not something that was easy to watch. But, you know, that's part of the show. And I am not a fan of editing movies for modern day audiences so we don't hurt people's feelings. I mean, was this stuff wrong? Minstrel Show, was that wrong? Yes, that stuff was horribly racist and it's steeped in racism. But that doesn't mean that that movie should disappear. And I like the fact that Universal is releasing this unchanged. Well, they have the colorized version of it as well, which does change the movie because it was shot in black and white. And the colorized version looks colorized. It's sort of that muted pastel that you get from a colorized version. But you got to preserve the movie for what it was. And you also have to look at it and say, yes, it was racist, but it was an understandable racism at the time. It's sort of like I was listening to Alice's Restaurant on Thanksgiving. And they have the F word in there for, you know, the gay slur, which meant something very different back in the 60s when that was made. So, I mean, if you're going to re-perform it, yeah, change it. But the original, don't go at censoring the recording. And I give them credit for releasing this unedited, as uncomfortable as it is to watch. So, but still, Holiday Inn, it's a charming little movie. And it's neat to see, Fred Astaire's great in it. And it's neat to see where it eventually turned into White Christmas. So I'm going to say that Holiday Inn kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
The other movies that were releasing this week on DVD and Blu-ray include American Assassin, Despicable Me 3, and Twin Peaks, A Limited Series Events. And that is it. Next week, I'm going to be talking about this little independent film called Star Wars The Last Jedi, along with Ferdinand and The Shape of Water. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.